Hello, everybody, and welcome to Revive Health's Daily Briefing Live for Tuesday, June 2nd. This is our 30-minute review of the latest, most important news, resources, and advice for health system marketers and communicators dealing with COVID-19. My name is Josh Schoonover. I'm your guest host today, and I'm joined by Chase Kleckner, Revive Health Senior Marketing Manager, and our workhorse of a show producer. Hi, Chase.
Hey, Josh. Good to have you on the show. Thanks for leading us today.
My pleasure. And today we're extremely fortunate to be joined by Dr. Robert Kahn, who is a professor of pediatrics and associate chair for community health at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Dr. Kahn serves as the executive lead for the hospital's communication and population health strategic plan, which seeks to help ensure that Cincinnati's 66,000 children are the healthiest in the nation. So Dr. Kahn, it is a pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks for having me.
So as with each show, we plan on covering the latest COVID-related news and how it relates to marketing and communications, share what we're seeing and hearing across the industry, and try to open it up for some questions toward the end. As we move through the show, please feel free to submit your questions through Zoom, and we'll try to protect time at the end to answer as many as we can. Certainly, you can all chat with each other throughout the process, but if there is a question that you want us to answer, please put it in the question queue. Additionally, as we go along the way, we'll be including any resources relevant to the conversation we're having in the chat function for you all to access at your leisure. As a matter of housekeeping, we want to let you know that you can subscribe to this podcast or download it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Just search for Revive Health Daily Briefing Live. We'll also be posting a recording of this episode at the end of the day on our website, www.thinkrevivehealth/COVID-19. You can find this podcast there as well as any previous ones. Just as a few disclaimers, we are not COVID-19 health experts, so medical or scientific advice is not the order of the day today, but certainly we have a lot of thoughts and perspectives on, you know, how to talk about this and what that means for marketing and communications. And while everyone's situation is unique, at the end, you'll have to make your best judgments on what your organization and your communities need. So let's dig into the meat of the matter. We'll start, as we always do, with a bit of an update on the latest numbers around cases globally and in the US. So we can see, you know, tracking the progress or tracking the number of cases, and ideally, very soon, seeing how much they're receding. We use Johns Hopkins dashboard for this. So at a quick count just right before this broadcast, the case count in the world was just under 6,310,000, with the death total coming in at 376,445. Bringing that home, our case count has exceeded 1.8 million. And the current death count as of right before this was 105,262. You know, we've been doing this podcast for 2 months, and like these numbers grow, and it never feels like it settles in. These are just exponential numbers. This is an important conversation. I should have set this up at the beginning, which is we're going to spend our time with Dr. Kahn today really talking about the importance of reaching and connecting with vulnerable populations in communities around our health systems and around the country. And how do we do that? This is a conversation that Dr. Kahn and I, or that we've been talking about before the George Floyd case, and certainly before the protests. And it seems as though, while it's an awful conversation to have, talking about health disparities, talking about vulnerable populations, talking about what that means and how we start to mitigate this inequity, doesn't come at a more pointed time than it does right now. So Dr. Kahn, I just throw that over to you to say, you know, just your observations as a public health professional, knowing that health disparities exist, and what we're seeing today in the news and social and conversations around the dinner table are a symptom of that inequity and some of those disparities as a result. So I just would ask you for some comments on that.
Absolutely. Thanks for lifting this up as a very current issue. I think we talk about racism as a fundamental cause of health disparities. There are many social drivers of health disparities, but when it comes to African-American health and well-being, 400 years of historical racism, systemic racism, and then present day interpersonal and systemic racism is a ongoing contributor with that COVID has highlighted, but we can talk more about the many ways it expresses itself over time.
Yeah, and you know, the timeliness of this conversation is quite striking. And just looking over what's been said about this, I mean, there's been plenty of articles written about who the most affected by, you know, this crisis are, and who is at a disadvantage even going into that. And we're going to talk a little bit about that going forward. Health Affairs has published a series of blog posts over the last several weeks, really digging into this idea of inequity and health disparities. And a recent one that was written last week by Shilpa Patel and Tricia McGinnis had this line in it, and I want to have you react to this. They wrote, COVID-19 has amplified the moral imperative and the business case for addressing health disparities experienced by communities of color in the current crisis environment.
Yeah, I think the operative word there is amplify. The issue of health disparities for kids in Cincinnati, as an example, is widespread. You know, if you look at our asthma admissions across the county, we'll see 5 to 15-fold variation in rates of admissions by neighborhood, with African-American lower-income neighborhoods having extraordinary rates of admission. So they've existed. And the systemic issues have existed. I think COVID brings a new, very bright light on it. And we certainly seem to be having a broader and deeper discussion across the population around the issues of racism and its contribution to COVID and elevated risks for minorities.
Yeah. Well, I think that tees us up for, you know, getting into a bit about the work that you do and then asking you a few questions about that. So at a high level, can you just tell us what you are focused on in terms of community outreach and community activations, and what are your list of priorities?
Great, thank you. Yeah, so Cincinnati Children's, to its credit, has really spent the last 5 to 10 years figuring out it's not enough to just be a great healthcare system and how to be a great health system. And so I, along with some other very esteemed colleagues, Uma Kodigal and others, have really tried to help guide the hospital. What would population health goals be for the city? So we have roughly 70,000 children in the city. How would we ensure they are thriving, even if they don't come through our doors on a regular basis? In that light, then when we look across the county around asthma, diabetes, cystic fibrosis, and others, trying to identify where the disparities are, but get beyond describing them and try to figure out what are the pathways creating them, and then who are high leverage partners in the community to address them. So our Cincinnati Public Schools, our Child Welfare Agency, our United Way, and then we've all been part of partnerships that don't lead somewhere. We've worked really hard to take our quality improvement work in the hospital, bring it out in the community to help guide our partnerships. So collectively working together multiple institutions to address child health disparities. I think a really important part of what's unique about disparities work is if you spend time working directly with families themselves to begin to get to issues that are core to them. So whatever we redesign is consonant with their issues around trust and value. And I think so that's been an important second part of what we've been doing around health disparities. Specifically, we focused on infant mortality, excess admissions, ready for kindergarten, and those kinds of issues.
A quick follow-up to that. You mentioned trust, and at times like this, and meaning the last few days, and certainly for historically, can you just talk a little bit about the importance of trust in the work that you do?
Absolutely. I think in the end, it's probably the most foundational to getting the work done. And it's one of those issues where everyone raises it, but if you said, how do you break that down? How do you sequentially build up trust? I think there's very few good frameworks that I've seen out there that specifically apply in this area. We work very closely with our partners in community relations as critical to building that sustained dialogue with communities. We bring families directly into our planning circles and execution circles, so they're guiding us along the way. And then we try really hard to deliver, because no matter how you do all the other stuff right, if you don't deliver better results for kids, in the end, trust is lost. And, you know, we could set this up for the, you know, for a deeper COVID discussion, but I think having spent time in the community for the last 5 years, building trust and getting results in the end has made it much easier for us to engage around some of the challenges presented by COVID.
So, you know, we said at the top of this, you know, a lot of articles have been written about the disproportionate effect on vulnerable communities in this time. You know, that's certainly true more broadly, but certainly at a time of a pandemic, it seems to be particularly acute. Can you talk a little bit as to why that is?
Sure. So, I mean, there's so many levels at which to approach it, but for those who haven't seen the data, you know, mortality rates and case rates are roughly double in minority and Latinx communities. I think the mortality rates are a little bit clearer. The infection rates are hard in part because testing access can be have disparities themselves. You know, the general way I think about disparities is sort of two boxes. They occur either because a segment is at increased risk or because there's diminished access to effective treatment. And the more the treatment is effective, the day we get a highly effective vaccine, the greater the opportunity for huge new disparities to arise. So when you think then about COVID, to your point, how is it working? You think about increased risk, more exposure in the occupations they have, less ability to stay home and protect oneself, less access to protective equipment, sanitizer. We've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how do you ensure vulnerable neighborhoods have protective equipment and sanitizer. And then on the flip side, access to testing is increasingly looming as a challenge. The health systems themselves may have adequate tests, but when you think about prisons, domestic violence shelters, dense housing complexes, how are we going to ensure excellent access there? And then finally, as I mentioned, the vaccines and therapies will just become ever more important across the fall. So if you were to say, where's the next biggest disparity related to COVID, I'd just keep a close eye on how vaccination is going to play out. Historically, a lot of low trust in vaccines that's been getting worse. And I can see that playing out in bad ways through the winter.
So that idea of access, certainly there is, you know, access to insurance, there is access to services, there's access to facilities. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me there's probably also a bit of an inequity in access to information in terms of who it's written for, how it gets to the people that need it. Can you talk a little bit about why it's so important to find ways to get information into and being able to understand communities enough to know how to communicate with them?
Right. I think we all are sensitized to that challenge, and I'd be hard pressed to say, even when I've scanned the literature for the very best in coronavirus related materials, you know, if you go to the CDC site, how to solve that challenge you just raised, I'm not sure you'd find really great answers there. But I think, you know, there's the right content, like what are the myths and important messages to get out? There's who are the right spokespeople to carry that message in what format and through what distribution channels, and then how diverse are the audiences in, you know, in your region that you're trying to reach? Ideally, you know, we would do that in partnership with influential community members. So I know our communications team has been reaching out to some of our critical anchor institutions or anchor agencies in, say, our neighborhoods with high rates of undocumented citizens. And how can we get that message out? What are the right messages? What are the myths? So I think that's, you know, a critical challenge, because in the absence of that, disparities will widen further. I'll just bring an example in which that was not done well. The original Back to Sleep campaign to reduce infant mortality, when it was rolled out, even though overall rates got better, the disparity widened in that time, right? So all that original messaging about how to put your baby on their back to sleep was sucked up by people who got that message in the way of the messages and the way it was delivered. Many others didn't get that message. And so in fact, even though overall things improved, the gap widened as part of it. And again, if it wasn't coming from a trusted messenger or a wise counsel, then the messages can easily be missed. And whether it's the serology testing or the immunizations or even the benefits of testing, I'll just raise one other issue that we're increasingly seeing is this notion of quarantining. You may have been exposed, so please stay home. I mean, the depth of belief in that has to match the urgency of maintaining an income. And what we're hearing is, it's very hard for families to give up income by staying home in a quarantine situation. So you can imagine then how important the messaging is. It can't be a quick call from a federal agency and expect everyone to answer the phone and listen to the message. So how do we get broader messaging out about something like that?
I should have asked this a little bit at the top, but I think it sets some context here. Can you talk a little bit about the diversity of the Cincinnati community and who it is that Cincinnati Children's serves locally? And we know that there's a regional, international population, but can you just talk a little bit about your community that you serve?
Sure. Now, I grew up in New Jersey, spent time in Boston and other locations, and I'd say we don't have that vast diversity of, say, Queens or Boston. That being said, our county and our city is probably 40 to 50% African American in the city, 30 to 40% white, a rapidly growing Latino community. Now, maybe 5 to 10%, but in some areas it's substantially larger, and it's the rate of change that's almost hard to acknowledge that you really got to adapt. We have West African community as well, as well as another range of other smaller percentage minorities. So not nearly as diverse as Queens, but it almost makes it more challenging because we have to adapt as an institution to that growing diversity. For a fair number of Arab-speaking families as well in our community and coming to the hospital.
Great, thank you. So with that in mind, can you talk a little bit, there's a number of initiatives you all have out in the community and some with great success. Can you just talk a little bit about what you have found and your teams and your colleagues have found as effective ways to reach disadvantaged communities across in the area?
Sure. And, the specifics will vary obviously by health system and by community, but I'll lift up one example where we followed our intuition, and I think it's actually playing out helpfully as a strategy. And I think it's a tough decision point for a lot of institutions, and that's around the issue of food insecurity. So I would assume in many of the cities reflected on the call today, the issue of lost jobs and food insecurity is a problem. And we have the Cincinnati Public Schools here who quickly opened up 24 meal delivery sites. And we have a standing relationship with the public schools around their education work. And what we really tried to do is partner with them around those sites and figured out how do we let them be the infrastructure and a platform around food, but then how do we partner with them and bring health information into that space? And then not just health information, how could we partner, for example, around child abuse and neglect? So a second related issue some of you may be aware of, kids aren't being seen. And across the country, rates of reported abuse and neglect are dropping. So then how, partnering with the schools and then bringing on a third partner, child welfare, do we use these physical access points both to engage partners, but even more importantly, to engage families, and which has led then to some joint initiatives around communications about recognizing abuse and neglect, and then how can we better support stressed families? So it's not just a children's hospital message, it's not just a school message, it's not just a child welfare message, each having strengths and weaknesses, but really how could we work together to get that message out? And then how do we use these physical contact points to become trusted local efforts? I'll just take one more step in which we said, these are 24 great sites, but we took our mapping ability and said, hey, where are vulnerable kids in the city? There are 45 neighborhoods, they're not all the same. We were able to then to sort of develop estimates of risk neighborhoods and then where pantries are. So not just Cincinnati Public Schools, but the food bank. And then working with city council, nudge some of the great nonprofits to start filling in holes in those neighborhoods. So there, you know, we put out a challenge. How could we make sure every vulnerable child has a food pantry or meal delivery site within one walking mile of their home? And again, it's just a different way of building a relationship, not a different way. It is a way, an important way to build relationships with the community to become a trusted presence. I think this, just build on that notion of trust. So now that we have trusted sites within 1 mile of every family, you can imagine what additional content we could start loading onto that. So now we're in conversations with public health about, hey, where would you put mobile testing sites? Where could you put mobile vaccination sites and so on? So again, it's many layers to it, but I think speaks to your earlier comment about trust and different ways than usual to engage with the community.
Have you, over, you know, say the last 5 years, and as you're out in the community really engaging, have you found, like, what are some of the common obstacles you bump up against?
Yeah, I'll say two, which one might be, what space are you in? Why are you going there, right? So one risk as we engaged in the food insecurity space would be a failure to message correctly. You know, is Children's Hospital in the food delivery business now? What's our mission? Is this a slippery slope? You know, so a barrier or risk is not having excellent communications, including sort of pre-work with the team here, making sure your management understands what our contribution to it is. I'll just say there was a press release prepped or two by some of our partners in which it was not so clear what Children's role was, and you know, really doing that pre-work to make sure everybody's in the right lane. So one risk is, you know, stepping in something and not communicating well. And even people thinking, you know, what's the health system doing here? Are they turning into the big gorilla? I think the other one that comes up, and Brian Hamilton, who I think is on the call today, and I were on a call yesterday, which is as you try to work in a vulnerable neighborhood, who are all the internal stakeholders who need to be engaged? And, you know, so I'm a physician and I work in the population and community health space. Brian leads the marketing and communications. We have community relations. We have government relations. So all of us trying to figure out, you may have a diversity and inclusion officer as well. All of us internally figuring out how do we work closely together. And then when you bring on a second institution, a university or somewhere else, they may have the equivalent. So I think if I was, you know, leading communications, but trying to figure out who's got the message. Is there a message? Are there seven messages? How do you bring it together? And I'd say that, you know, the current pandemic has given us an opportunity to get better aligned internally and then begin to reach out with a more coherent voice. So, but both a risk, but also an opportunity to get further faster for future challenges.
So you bring up a good point. You talked about, you know, how are you getting all of your internal stakeholders on board and who's owning the message and how do we make sure there's consistency for that? Can you, you know, you're on the front lines of this. You get to see a lot of things in and outside the organization. I would love to just open this up to you of, you know, based on your experience, what advice do you have for marketing and communications professionals in a health system, you know, specifically to their role and the opportunity to be able to reach folks who actually, who absolutely need the information and the content to live better lives?
Yeah, gosh. Great question again. And this is just one person's perspective. I think one piece that we found that I'd love for us to continue to build on is the role of the front lines. Everybody in a crisis, including community members, one of the greatest needs was to make a difference, right? If you remember those first 8 weeks or 6 weeks, yes, everybody was scared, but everyone wanted something that they could do to contribute. So we had a bunch of de novo efforts popping up in terms of ways to communicate messages, you know, small YouTube segments. And I think it was a great opportunity for us to engage our communications experts with people at the furthest reaches of the front lines and sort of harvest or crowdsource what are the problems you're seeing, what are the messages you wish to get out. So, you know, you don't want 1,000 points of light, but you also want to make sure, you know, you're hearing direct from the front line. So I think an opportunity is engage with some frontline innovators. You know, not all of them, you can't do all of them. They won't do it all well, but look for future leaders, because as we said at the start, right, building trust is so important. So if we get this right, it'll carry forward to future challenges.
So a final question here for you, which is, I know we've had some separate discussions about this, but, you know, there's a particularly acute focus, one, because of COVID, two, because of some of the protests that are going along. And it brings a lot of this conversation to the moment, right? But this idea of inequity, of health disparities, of disadvantaged communities will go on beyond this pandemic, right? So can you just, what would your kind of takeaway advice for people to not let this fall off your radar? This isn't a moment in time, this is a flashpoint. And how people should be thinking about it going forward.
Right. I mean, right. We said for the past 400 years, certainly for the past 50 years of our health systems, what an opportunity to build for the next 10 years. So even if it requires some additional investment now, if you think what's the 5-year payoff on this, I think it's worth going all in now and building things that will finding those elements that can and should be sustained for the next half decade. And in part, I would just say the value premise, as many of us are shifting somewhat from volume to value-based payment, we're keeping families healthy, is what's great for the bottom line. I think it's all the more reason to do those upfront investments now in addressing health disparities and communicating well about them.
I lied. There is one more question that I have for you, which is all of this takes like a colossal effort from a health system, right? To really be able to rally the thinking and the resources around this kind of a focus. In just a few moments, I don't want to force you into a dissertation on this, but can you just talk a little bit about how you and colleagues have been able to really direct the focus on inequity and vulnerable communities at Cincinnati Children's? Because that's a big lift, right?
Yeah, I mean, it has been. And I'd say a huge part of it is great leadership. So connecting with the senior leaders, our CEO and our board chair not only care passionately about the issue, but they've taken time to work with internal communications as well to ensure that that message gets out internally, that it's a priority now and going forward for the future of the hospital. It does and has required some investment in looking toward the future. So luckily I've had folks on my team. And then, you know, frankly, getting up in front of other leaders and lifting up the data to them and saying, hey, if we're about health, how can we feel comfortable knowing that 25% of our population is well below the mean? You know, what can we do together? What resources can we bring to you? And it's sort of a movement. We're trying to build towards a bit of a campaign movement across all the subspecialties in the hospital. And we just had a conversation with the CEO today. How do we use this moment to give clinical leaders the data they need to set goals in the upcoming year to address some of the, in particular, black-white disparities in condition outcomes?
Well, Dr. Khan, I can't thank you enough for joining us today and sharing a bit of your perspective at a time like this. So we greatly appreciate the time, knowing how much you have to accomplish over there.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Great. So that's it for today's show. Please let us know if there's something you'd like us to cover tomorrow or in future sessions. Tomorrow for our session, we have Sasha Boghossian joining us with guest hosts alongside Corey Ashford, who's the Director of Integrated Communications Division at the American College of Surgeons. She'll be giving insight about the concerns and the priorities and the opportunities that are top of mind for surgeons so that health system marketers can best engage with surgeons as they begin transitioning and resuming some of the surgery services. Please remember to visit www.thinkrevivehealth.com/COVID-19 for a recording of today's episode, as well as all of our content. And again, you can subscribe to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts to hear this later. And to all of you out there, please hang in there, stay safe, keep up the amazing work you're doing. The skills that you bring as marketing and communications professionals have probably never been more important, have never mattered more. And we know this because audiences are looking to us more than anyone else to help them navigate these times. So We'll be back tomorrow and every week and every weekday until this passes. So we will talk to you then. Thank you.